We're continuing the interview with Robert Shoemaker on December 8th, 1999 in Berkeley, California.
Well, they finally got the plant started and started leaching. And they began to realize that the water coming out from underneath the dam from these springs contained cyanide solution and some gold too, and this was had been leaking through the plastic, and so they started pumping it over back. They collected it and started pumping it over back into the above the dam. And this flow became amounted to about 5 million gallons a month. And I kept telling them that they had to do something about this because this valley was slowly filling up with leach solution at the rate of 5 million gallons a month. And the ore that was underwater was covered with leach solution was not being pumped out of the heap. They had mounted the pump inside of 5 or 6 foot diameter pipes that went vertically down into the heap and were supposedly down at the bottom of the heap, ended at the bottom of the heap, and they had rails mounted in these pipes, there were two of them, so that they could pull the pumps out. And the weight of the ore on these pipes deformed the pipes and deformed the rails, and the pumps didn't work anymore. They couldn't pull them out for maintenance, and so they had to drop pumps in on cables, and they couldn't get them clear down to the bottom of the valley where the solution was building up.
How deep was this?
Well, the heap at that point was about 200 feet high. That Ooh. Is, the dam was 200 feet high. And then as it went up the valley, the heap got less thick, although they added ore above the height of the dam back up as you went up the valley. Mm-hmm. And this old mine that Cleveland Cliffs had put in was draining out acid water from the sulfides that the ore body was in, or that part of the ore body contained. And that acid drainage went into a creek, and that creek met converged with another creek that came from the valley that the heap was in, and they converged about a mile below the plant. And I kept saying that they converged several miles below the plant, but there was no fish or no life at all in this creek that had acid in it, and it was full of iron oxide, and the whole creek bed was just red with iron oxide. And I kept trying to get them to combine the two right at the plant, because the acid would have been neutralized by the base in the water from the plant. I was trying to get them to mix the barren solution that contained no gold with that acid water, which would have resulted in neutralizing the acid and not caused any problems downstream. And it would have taken care of this 5 million gallons increase in the heap every month.
You would have had to pump the water up from that creek.
Well, we would have only had to pump it just over a slight hill. But they didn't, the way the laws were set up, they, even though that adit was on their property, the state of Colorado didn't force them to do anything about that acid mine drainage. In fact, they didn't, this Galactic didn't want to even touch it, because if they said if they touched it, did anything with it, then they would be committed to.
They would be liable.
They would be liable.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I can't quite believe that, because it was such, they could so easily have neutralized it with this barren solution. And
do you know if anyone from Cleveland Cliffs ever
got interested in this? Well, Cliffs was out of it. That had been years before. And so
I would think they would have been concerned about.
I don't know how that turned out. But anyway, they didn't use this barren solution. And this heap kept getting more water in it every month, until eventually there was over 100 million gallons of water. And after a couple of years, they had a spill, which got the EPA involved, and then they put in a. The EPA insisted on them putting in a plant to mix hydrogen peroxide with the cyanide that was going down this creek, because they couldn't put any more water behind this dam, and it was terrible, and it was just a complete mess.
How had they, or had they planned originally to cope with it? I mean, were they going to, after the solution went through the rocks, how would they get the rocks out of there?
Well, the waste rock was just left there in that, behind that dam.
They had not planned to remove it at all?
No, they hadn't planned to remove that at all.
So it seems pretty obvious it would fill up and.
Well, it would fill up with water. They were hoping that they could evaporate the excess water if they had any, but they wouldn't really have had any if it hadn't been adding this fresh water from these springs underneath the heap.
And the drains weren't working.
Well, the drains were working, but it would drain water into the creek, so they couldn't drain this water with cyanide in it into the creek, so they had to pump it back over, and besides it had gold in it.
Mm-hmm.
But that,
so well, they miscalculated the amount of water there would be.
Yeah. So anyway, they put in this hydrogen peroxide plant to neutralize barren solution in the hopes that it would give them water that was sufficiently clean and it could be put into the creek. And EPA didn't know anything about what they were doing, and they shouldn't have used hydrogen peroxide, they should have used ferrous sulfate. And ferrous sulfate. Okay. And they didn't, and they had, and then they, the EPA imposed such strict conditions on Galactic and Summitville Consolidated Mining Company, is what they called it up there, that the there was a little bit of copper in the ore, not enough to hurt anything, not enough to hurt any fish or anything else, but of course there wasn't any fish in this creek for clear down for another 30 miles because of the, until it met the Alamosa River, which then diluted the acid mine water and would have diluted the cyanide too. And there wouldn't have been any cyanide left in the water down there anyway after a mile or so, because it would be aerated and decomposed. But the EPA finally forced them to shut down, and of course they weren't making any money anyway. They hadn't made any money because of all of these problems, and so they declared bankruptcy, and then the EPA took it over, and so far they've spent something like $100 million, and they haven't solved the problem. A group of mining companies, including Newmont, and I don't know who else, offered to help the EPA and actually kind of take charge of trying to reclaim this disaster up there. But the EPA said no, and they have been working with that hydrogen peroxide plant ever since, and it isn't the right thing to do. It's kind of,
it's become such a symbol now. Everybody who's,
yes,
anti-mining brings up Summitville. And
well, actually, for many years that creek had no fish in it because of the acid mining mine drainage, and but by the time when it got to the Alamosa River, then it was diluted so much it never hurt anything. And but the EPA overreacted like everything else. And I understand that the EPA has never completed the reclamation of any of these, what do they call them, hazardous?
Superfund?
Pardon?
Superfund?
Superfund. They've never completed any of these Superfund projects. They're still working on them, even right from the very start. They've never completed one. And it's just an enormous waste of money. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I was at the dedication ceremony. I was there. They had speeches and everything, and then they took us for a ride on the railroad that goes from Silverton to
Durango.
Durango. And Freeland was there and made a speech, and after the speech he came over to me and asked me to serve on the board of directors of Galactic. And I very politely turned him down, and I'm certainly glad that I did.
Aren't you glad you did?
It was a very frustrating couple of years that I spent there, because they just didn't know what they were doing, and they had so many problems that were unsolvable.
Mm. Well, that's one place that seemed, everyone calls it a disaster, and I guess everyone agrees it was a disaster, wasn't it?
Well, it is, as you say, it's become a symbol of disaster in the mining industry, and it is certainly it is Galactic's fault. It was too low grade. It was one of these places where you couldn't make a single mistake. And they made mistakes in everything. The crushing plant that they had designed, I didn't agree with it. And yet, between Roger Leonard and Bechtel, they built it, and it was an enormous problem. They didn't cover up the conveyors with so that they got buried in snow. In the wintertime, enormous snowfall up there. And there were just all kinds of problems.
Well, when you're called in as a consultant in a case like that, and they ignore your advice, what?
Well, the only thing you can do is quit, and that's what I did after a couple of years. Well, then I saw that they were going to go belly up, and I just quit. I told them I just couldn't take this anymore.
But you stayed with it through to the dedication.
Oh, well, the dedication was right at the start.
I see.
And that is, as soon as the plant got operating. But it was too much of a mess, and I didn't want to be associated with it anymore.
No. They did get into operation?
Oh, yeah, they ran it for, I guess, 18 months or perhaps 2 years. Mm-hmm. I quit probably 6 months before they shut down. They just wouldn't. They didn't have any money to do things right, and they had a lot of stubborn people. Ed Roper had quit, and he completely disappeared. I've never heard from him again. I don't know where he was. He was given a lot of stock in the company, and Friedland had run the price of that stock up with all of his great speeches about how wonderful this plant was going to be, and of course all that money was lost. But Ed sold out his stock and made himself some millions, and I guess maybe he just retired from then on, I don't know.
Leonard, what happened to him? Did Leonard stay?
No, he quit, and he went to Africa, in Ghana.
Well, it was a bad story.
Did I talk to you about the when I was at with David Lowell at Andacoya?
No, I don't think so.
And they had the Chilean mills and the superintendent of the Chilean mill had this secret ingredient.
Oh, you know, I can't remember. I think you told me, I think we talked about it when it was off the tape. I don't believe we taped that.
I don't think so.
I don't think so.
We were talking up there.
I think it was just when we were talking.
I think that's kind of an interesting.
Or if so, let's do it, and if it's a duplication, we'll cut one out. But I think that was something we just talked about. I remember what the secret ingredient was. I don't believe you taped it. Let's do that. Okay. Incidentally, since then I have interviewed David Lowell.
Oh, yeah.
At that time I hadn't met him, but I have done his oral history this last year. So let's talk about your associations with David Lowell.
All right. Are you ready?
Yes.
I had known David Lowell for quite a while, and he had asked me to get involved in the metallurgy of a heap leach project down in near Antofagasta for his company, which was called Minera del Inca. And that I supervised the test work down there and on this for a heap leach plant, and but then it was sold to a drilling contractor who had a lot of extra money and who eventually then sold out to a subsidiary of Battle Mountain Gold. But anyway, when I went down there to do that, to take a look at the sampling and recommend how it should be sampled for the metallurgical test work. We went up to the town of Andacolla, A-N-D-A-C-O-L-L-A, and he wanted to look at this area. There had been an old copper mine up there, and there was a falling down concentrator and a falling down smelter that hadn't been run for many years. But there were dozens of very small gold mines there, run by anywhere from two to a half a dozen people each. And I don't know how many mines, but there were a lot of them. And in the little town of Andacolla, which was only a few hundred people, and this was quite a ways up in the Andes, not really high, but it was probably up 8 or 9,000 feet. And there were about two dozen Chilean mills. They call them trapiches, T-R-A-P-E-C-H-E, and they each one of them had what is called one or more Chilean mills, and these are large, you might say, wheels. There's two wheels on an axle, and these wheels are about 4 feet in diameter, and they're made, many of them are just chiseled out of one piece of rock and with a hole drilled in the center of them, and they are they have a rim that's about 8 to 10 inches wide, and the center of the wheel is probably 14, 16 inches wide, where the axle goes through. And they are turned in a circular trough made out of concrete with a steel bottom. And they're turned.
Now they rotate horizontally?
The wheels are about, say, 4 feet apart on a horizontal shaft, and then there's a vertical shaft connected to the horizontal shaft that turns these wheels around in a circle.
But are the wheels going horizontally or like a wagon? They're not
like a wagon wheel.
Like a wagon wheel, okay.
And they are just going around in a circle, and they shovel ore into the path of these wheels, and the wheels are also pivoted so that the axle has got a universal joint on it, so that when it runs over a big rock, well, the wheel will lift up, one of the two wheels or both of them. And they actually can put rock in as big as 5 and 6 inches. And the sides of this concrete bowl that these wheels run in are kind of sloping, and they have copper plates hanging around the on this sloping side, and as the wheels turn, they add water, and as the ore is crushed and ground in this into this slurry, the slurry is splashed up onto these copper plates, which are coated with amalgam with mercury, and the gold that is in the ore then is collected on the mercury amalgam plate. And I'd never seen one of these. I'd seen pictures of them.
I've heard the term, but I've never known what they, how they were operated.
And
now, what they have motors then, little motors.
They had 15 horse electric motors. Mm-hmm. The power plant had, or the power lines had gone up there originally for this copper plant, which they still had electric lights and enough power to run these little mills. And there was, as I say, perhaps a dozen of these, with one to three of the Chilean mills in there.
Mm-hmm.
In the plant, and when we arrived there, they were at this one little plant. There were three of these Chilean mills, and they were taking these copper plates out of the mills and replacing them right away, and while they cleaned the amalgam off of the gold amalgam off of the plate, and they laid these copper plates. They were about an eighth of an inch thick and say 12 or 14 inches wide and about 4 feet long. They laid them on a couple of boards that were sitting on top of a water tank, which was made out of a couple of 55-gallon drums cut in half. And first they would scrape the amalgam, as much of it as they could, off of the plate with a section of rubber belting that they'd cut with a sharp edge on it, and then they would put and the amalgam would go down into the water, and then they would recover that and put it through a small retort and make the recover the gold and recover the mercury. And after they had scraped the amalgam off of the plate, they would then put sand on the plate and rub the sand in to make remaining mercury amalgam on there very smooth, and they would just scour them, and it would also remove other things that would get in the amalgam, like copper and so on, and refresh the plate. And then they would take a bottle that had a cork in it with a small hole, and the bottle contained mercury, and they'd sprinkle the mercury around on the plate and then rub that in with their hands. And of course, that wouldn't be allowed here in the United States, but nobody ever got, they didn't know that they could get mercury poisoning, because they never did. And then they would get that all, just before they did that, before they put the mercury on, they had a bottle, the plastic liter bottle, and it was full of this yellow fluid. And they sprinkled that on the plate and scrubbed that in with the in with their hands also. This is between the sand and the mercury. And all mill superintendents who have ever used mercury amalgamation plates it seemed like all had their secret ingredient to make these amalgam plates pick up the gold more efficiently, and they used everything, salt and vinegar and borax, and I don't think any of it ever worked. But they would never tell, they had a reputation of never telling anybody what their secret ingredient was. And I asked David, who spoke Spanish, to ask the foreman there what this yellow fluid was. And he said to David, and David translated, that he couldn't tell me because that was, it was his secret ingredient for making the amalgam plates perform better. And I asked David to tell him that I was from the United States and that I was a metallurgist and I was very much interested, and I would promise not to tell anyone what it was if he would tell me. And so he did. He told David, and David told me, and it was a bottle of his own urine. And I had never heard of that before, and I said, David, ask him if wouldn't it be better if he used the urine from 18-year-old virgins? And he laughed, and he said back to David that it would be very much better, but there were no 18-year-old virgins in Andacoya.
Oh dear. Did you work with David any other time?
I worked with him on...
Didn't you take a trip to China with him?
I went to China with him, and we did that for DuPont.
I don't know that you've talked about that, have you?
I don't
believe you have.
I don't think so. That's
no.
Still...
That's coming.
Still okay. To come.
All right.
I might.
Okay. You were going to talk about mistakes that have been made.
I mentioned all the mistakes at Summitville, but I was hired by an outfit called AMOK Uranium, AMOK. They had a uranium mine. It was a French company. I don't know what AMOK stood for, but they had a uranium mine up in northern Saskatchewan. And they had put in a mill and had one of the Canadian engineering firms put in this mill. And it was a case of which happens fairly often, that the owner does not furnish enough people to oversee the engineering firm, and the engineers are not often operators, and so they didn't have any, the engineering firm didn't have any guidance, and they made a number of mistakes. And the plant, they had a lot of trouble, AMOK did, when the plant was finished and they tried to run it. And so they hired me to come up and take a look at what the engineering firm had done, and to see if they should sue. Well, it was, in my opinion, it was partly their own fault, because they hadn't overseen the engineering firm. But then again, the engineering firm made some horrible mistakes, and one of them was that they put a lot of their their piping, well, not only water pump, water piping, but slurry piping and air piping right in front of the main air intake to the plant building. And this was in northern Saskatchewan, up in the tundra area, and with enormously cold winters, and the fresh air they brought in was in, they had furnaces in their air heating devices, you know, to heat the air. But all of these pipes promptly froze up and shut them down and caused quite a bit of damage in the plant, because everything got frozen. Not only those pipes, but they had to shut down the heating plant, and they finally got started back up again. Another one was they had a fire loop piping around the entire plant out from the plant building with fire hydrants, and this was buried in the permafrost. And the way that they it was insulated too, even though it was buried, but it would have frozen if they hadn't. They would pump water through this loop constantly, and as long as the water is moving, it doesn't freeze, even though below freezing temperature. And there is some heat put into it because of the pump itself is inefficient, and that amounts to heat. Well, anyway, the fire loop, it didn't make a complete circle. It was two half circles, and those pipes at the far end, they were supposed to be joined, and they weren't, and so their whole fire system froze up, which was a horrible mistake. Well, I finally told them that I thought that it would cost them probably more than they would be able to get out of it if they sued, so they ought to try and settle out of court, which they did, and they did collect quite a bit of money from the engineering firm, because the engineering firm didn't want the bad publicity, and it was, they were justified in collecting some money, but it was too bad that people don't oversee their engineers like they should, and it's too bad that these mistakes are just made over and over again since the time of Agricola.
I think the engineers would have known it gets very cold in northern Saskatchewan. That doesn't take a...
Terrible.
As they say, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to know that.
There was another one that made a lot of mistakes, which was the Northumberland mine over north of the Smoky Valley heap leach operation, which is partly owned by Homestake and partly by Echo Bay. And this
would be
was
in Nevada?
Yes. And this was, Northumberland was owned by the Amoco Oil Company. And they had a vice president from the oil company they established a minerals division. This is during the time when all oil companies were trying to get into mining business. And this vice president, they put him in charge of this construction of this heap leach operation. And the mine was at an altitude of, I don't know, 9 or 10,000 feet. And they had to, they put the crushing plant up at that, up at the mine, and then haul the ore down the hill to Smoky Valley, which is only probably 5 or at the most 6,000 feet. And they had a 12-mile haul, and it was low grade to start with. This vice president, he was going to make a name for himself because he was ready to retire. And
do you want to say his name?
He wanted the glory of their first gold mine.
Do you want to name him?
I would really rather not.
Okay.
But he had drawings from 7 different engineering firms. Wow. He was trying. He got a little piece of the plant done here, another piece done there, another piece done someplace else. And when they finally hired a construction contractor and tried to put all these pieces together, it was just a complete mess. But they finally got it built, and finally got it repaired enough so that the plant would run and it would extract gold. But the trouble was they couldn't leach any of the gold out of this ore. The ore had a lot of clays and fines in it, and the heaps were being built right near the plant, and they had the haul trucks that they used to bring the ore down off this hill were bottom dump. The tractor or the truck would pull 2 bottom dump trailers, and they were normal type of trailers and tires that would run on a highway. And they put a lot of money into this road coming down the hill. They bought cheap trucks, and these trucks, although they were diesel, they didn't have proper retarders on them, so they could use the engine for braking. And they lost, I think, 3 of their trucks coming down that hill before I got there, and killed one of the drivers. They just tried to use the brakes, and the brakes were worn. The retarder wouldn't work well enough, and they had to use the brakes, and the brakes wore out, and they ran off the road. You know? But they were driving these trucks up on top of the heap and dumping this crushed ore in windrows. Mm-hmm. And these high pressure tires that are built for highway travel were just compacting this ore. Just, it was so hard, it was almost like asphalt, you know, an asphalt road. And they had a dozer up there on top of the heap, and were flattening out these windrows, and then these trucks were driving all over this heap, and it was just virtually solid rock. Not quite that, but almost. And anyway, I got a call from the Amoco people in Denver, and they asked me to go out and take a look at this. And that's one of the major things that I looked at, and I told them that they just couldn't do this. It was just, they had to dump in one spot and push the ore with the dozer to distribute it around on the heap. They could not use those trucks on, run those trucks on top of those heaps. And that was the major thing that I made some suggestions about the crushing plant and also the plant itself. But that was the major thing. And so they got my report, and they called me up, and they said that they were going to have this manager told him that he couldn't run the trucks on there anymore, on the heaps anymore. And a month went by, and they called me up again, and they asked me to meet them their headquarters are in Denver, and they asked me to meet them in Salt Lake City. They were bringing their company airplane out, and then I would fly with them over to Nevada to where the Northumberland plant was, and they had an airstrip there. And as we got into the plant, over the plant, I asked him to ask the pilot if he would make a circle of the operation. And here they were still running the trucks over this heap. And consequently, when we landed, first thing that the vice president did was fire the manager. And that's where I first met Roger Leonard. And in fact, I recommended him to his mill superintendent there. I'd known him, I had first met him over at Pinson, the Pinson mine. But I recommended they hire him because their mill superintendent didn't know anything about it. And a gold plant. It's just typical of some of these oil companies what they did. Like, ARCO bought Anaconda and found they didn't know what they were doing. And every one of these have been disasters. I think the only oil company that's still really in the mining business is Exxon, and they have a major piece of one of the large copper mines down in Chile. But every one of them, even they have had a couple of plants that have been disasters, and they'll never get their money back.
It's interesting that there's all this talk about corporate culture, but I guess the mining culture and the oil culture just don't go together, do they?
No, they certainly don't. They certainly don't. It's mining isn't really a very profitable business.
Mm-hmm.
I was reading a report put out by the National Science Foundation the other day on the book, in fact, on mining in the United States, and now the laws are enforced badly by the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management and the EPA and so on. Anyway, it mentioned in there that the mining companies make, on the average, one of the lowest returns on investments of any industry in the United States. It doesn't take, very, very few mines are really end up as, for instance, like Homestead was lasting over 100 years. But on the other hand, Homestead in the last few years has not really done, they've done virtually nothing except lose money or trade dollars. I guess they're in a little better shape now, but they've had some very disastrous years, which takes many years to make up.
Mm-hmm.
Many, many good years to make up for one bad year.
Mm-hmm.
I worked in South America, I think I mentioned, for CVRD, but I put the first, or helped them put in the first heap leach plant in Brazil.
What was this,
CVRD, you know, it's a company of Mineira, Vale do Rio Doce. Or no, Company of Vale do Rio Doce. We had it mentioned in the previous. But this one was called, it was a gold deposit called Fazenda Brasileira. I'll give you the spelling of that later.
Okay.
It was in Bahia Providence, up north of probably 300 miles north of Rio and west of Salvador, which is on the coast. But I, they had been doing the research work at the Belo Horizonte Laboratory, and they couldn't get any activated carbon. At that time, it was very difficult to import things into Brazil. And I had been working on something else, and when I found out they wanted, this might turn out to be a heap leach, the next time I went down, I took a couple of 2-liter bottles of activated carbon, or activated charcoal, down with me, and put them in my bag. And the customs, unfortunately, opened my bag at that time, and I knew I was in for trouble there, and he asked me what it was, and I said it was activated charcoal, and he said, what are you going to use it for? And I thought quick, and I says, I can't drink the water here, and I filter this through activated charcoal to keep me from getting sick. And he says, okay, fine, go ahead. And
good.
Later on, I consulted on that and helped them with their test work. And then when they started to build the plant, they were using what we call wobblers to distribute the solution on top of the heap, the cyanide solution. Wigglers, I'm sorry. And wigglers, this was in the early days of heap leaching, and they used pieces of surgical tubing, that were about 18 inches long and connected to the distribution pipes. And these things whip around, they wiggle, and they weren't very good. They didn't have a even coverage of the solution, or make an even coverage of the solution, of the leach solution. And so I smuggled in a half a suitcase load of what we call wobblers at the time, which was a plastic sprinkler. And they used those on the heap that they put in, along with wigglers, and they worked so much better that they finally got a special license to import some, and then they started making them down there, and the company started making them down there.
So you stimulated the business down there.
Yeah, having to smuggle things in like that is interesting.
What would you have said if they'd caught you with the wobblers?
Well, they would have confiscated those, because they knew they would have known I was going to do something with them, sell them or something. But they didn't happen to open my suitcase at that time. I can talk a little bit about J.P. Morgan.
Well, that's a good old name.
I got a call one day from the J.P. Morgan people, and they had loaned quite a large amount of money to an outfit called Geobiotics over here in Hayward. And this was a small startup company doing research on, and they were producing enzymes, but they were doing research on other things, and for some reason or other they thought they could develop a process for treating carbonaceous gold ores. And so they wanted some more money, and Morgan wanted me to come and go down there and take a look, see if this might be something. They didn't want to loan them any more money without assurance they'd get it back. And so I drove down there and stayed overnight in Hayward and went to the plant the next morning, and I spent most of the day there, and they wouldn't tell me anything. And they just wouldn't tell me anything.
No secret ingredient?
It was all so secret that they wouldn't tell me anything. So I went back home and I called up the person at J.P. Morgan and said that was a complete bust and they wouldn't tell me anything. And he said, well, you go back tomorrow, and he said, they will tell you everything. He was pretty mad. And, so I went back down the next day after I got home, or the day after I got home. And even then, it was like pulling teeth trying to get information out. But they had this carbonaceous gold ore business has been solved by roasting, and some of it has been solved by ultra fine grinding, and some of it has been solved now by bacterial leaching. But they had developed a process of flotation of the carbonaceous material from the ore, and then they would burn that carbon and recover the gold from it, and then they would cyanide the residue from the flotation. I finally got that out of it. And that sounded familiar to me. And then I realized that I'd been talking with Frank McQuiston at one time, and when I was with him over at Carlin, and they had developed the very same process over at Carlin, but it hadn't worked. Mm-hmm. And these people had gotten a hold of a sample of ore from some place that contained some carbonaceous in it, carbonaceous material. And they had spent several months and then they wanted a lot more money from J.P. Morgan to develop this. And I told J.P. Morgan, I didn't tell these people it's geobiotic, but I told that geobiotics had developed a process which was already invented, but it hadn't worked. And it would, so apparently they didn't loan them any money.
But that's what the consultant is good for.
Yeah, that's right. I wanted to talk about the.
I'm nervous when I see you skipping through a lot of things. Are you?
Well, some of these are just notes.
Okay. I don't want to miss anything good.
When I was working for CBRD,
okay.
They asked me to go up to their Coway mine, which was north of Belo Horizonte by about 70 or 80 miles. It was a very large iron ore plant that they mined 60,000 tons a day of iron ore, and the iron was in the form of specular hematite. It was hematite, which is iron oxide, two irons and three oxygens, but it was in a different crystal form than normal hematite, and it was called specular hematite. And this specular hematite is black, and it forms in small crystals and doesn't make a homogeneous mass. It breaks up easily into these little crystals, which are maybe an eighth of an inch long. And there was clay mixed in with this, but the ore, when they removed it, when they shoveled it from the pit face into the truck, it just virtually all broke apart. They didn't have to crush it. They just put it in they fed it into a large drum with water, and the drum had blades in it. And and it just all pulped up into an easily handled slurry that they separated the, after cycloning it to remove the clay, the cyclone underflow went to magnetic separators, high intensity magnetic separators, because a normal magnetic separator will not pick up any hematite. Hematite is not really very magnetic, not at all magnetic except under very high intensity magnetic separation. Well, they had a tailing pond. The plant was up on a kind of an escarpment, and there was they dumped their tailings over this escarpment, and they went down a kind of a little narrow canyon that gradually spread out, and 60,000 tons a day of, well, there was probably only maybe 20,000 tons a day of tailings going out there, but with the water too. And this almost like a waterfall down this escarpment into this canyon, and then as the canyon widened out, it was there was deposits of tailings in this canyon that had kind of filled it partially full, not very thick because it was swaying quite a bit. And then they had this enormous tailing pond out at the end of this little canyon. And